Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up in just a bit, construction of North Dakota's long-awaited military gallery has been paused, and we'll dig into that issue in our segment, A Closer Look with the Monitor. And science comes alive this summer, of course, at the North Dakota Gateway to Science. STEM educator Emily Montgomery will be our guest to tell us what visitors can expect if they're interested in becoming a chemist or solve real-world problems. But first, the world of AI we lead with in our segment, Tech with Peck. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Artificial intelligence, it's evolving at a breathtaking pace. It's writing, it's creating, it's analyzing, it's answering questions, and in some cases, replacing work that once required people. That's us. And at the same time, AI-generated images and videos are becoming so convincing that it can be difficult to separate fact from fiction. And in the growing demand for massive AI data centers, it's clear that this technology is changing more than just our computers. Joining us for another edition of Tech with Peck is our good friend George Peck. George, welcome back to Main Street.
Well, thank you. And you said we're people, and I know that's some people would say that's subject to interpretation.
That's right.
You know, this is a subject that we've just kind of been putting off, and we would have to eventually get to it. And it's one we could probably spend 10 hours on, not 10 minutes. But, you know, this was an important topic, and I actually wanted to bring some other colleagues in. So I actually went to my local NPR affiliate and got a couple of folks to join us today to talk about it kind of ethics and AI and where AI is going. Welcome.
Today, we're going to explore an AI actress that recently caused Hollywood to suffer an absolute industry-wide meltdown.
Yeah. That was crazy.
We'll look at how political operatives are flooding our feeds with reality-bending AI slop and the hidden mechanics of why they do it. And finally, we'll uncover the shocking reason why Americans are suddenly saying they would rather have a nuclear power plant in their backyard than an AI data center.
And our mission is to basically map out how generative AI is aggressively colliding with our actual reality.
Now, I introduced myself as George Peck, and you folks didn't. So let us know who you are, just to make sure we're completely in the know here.
You have not been listening to human beings.
Neither of us are real.
We are entirely AI-generated voices, reading a script synthesized by an AI, powered by the very data centers we just critiqued.
So, Craig, welcome to Notebook LM. Okay?
So, George, that's such good quality. You just don't know. We could have probably continued having that conversation for the next hour, and they would have been happy to converse with us.
First of all, my prompt was a very specific, a 3 minutes, and they didn't. It was 19 minutes long, so I had to go edit it. Could probably find some kind of an AI editor tool, which would be a good idea. I'm looking for more AI in my audio editing. But in any event, Notebook LM was one of the first examples. This was something that I actually found out about a year ago in my company that I work for, when I was going to do some enablement for a team, and someone goes, oh, don't bother doing that. Just take the document you're going to use and put it into Notebook LM and have them do the podcast. And it sounds amazingly NPR-ish, but that is Notebook LM. It's a Google tool, and it is entirely generative AI. Now, I probably shouldn't say the name of the company I work for because I'm going to run afoul of my legal department, but we are proclaiming agents and humans working together. I'd say it would be honest to say agents and fewer humans working together. But this is one of the products that we offer straight out of our website. Have a listen to this.
Hi, Thomas. Thanks for calling into Astro Appliances. How's your day going?
Well, it's going well so far, but I'm a little frustrated with one of my washing machines.
I'm sorry to hear that. I'm seeing some data from your washing machine that there's been a couple of failed cycle starts from the system's diagnostics. There seems to be a blockage in the detergent tray area of the washing machine. If you are near your machine, I can help you start fixing that issue.
So I don't know where the accent came from, but I'm imagining we can just add a prompt that adds an Irish accent or a slight British accent.
Make a woman do whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and the question is, if we're leading into kind of ethics, there would have been a time that there was a real human who would have taken that call. Now, you would have had to wait maybe 20 minutes for that human. that human would have had to do a lot more research potentially before the human gave that response. Now, a little bit earlier in my company's life cycle of AI agents, that would not have been possible voice-wise. That would have been an agentic. That's the term we now use. Agentic is an everyday term for me. That would have been an agentic conversation that replaced a generic chat bot. So now you see AI-generated chat rather than just plain old, the original chat bots, now morphing into voice-generated from not real human beings. Is this ethical? So the question I have as we think about this and talk about this is, if we talk about AI ethics, we talk about AI replacing humans, and that is something that we should probably not be surprised about. I think back in the scene in A Christmas Carol when Marley and Scrooge are sitting at accounting at desks with accounting ledgers doing accounting. They're balancing the books. Well, we necessarily wouldn't in that era have expected QuickBooks to replace, you know, Scrooge and Marley, but it did. Computers and software have been replacing humans in many areas for many years. So to a certain extent, AI replacing some humans is not necessarily unexpected, and I don't know that that would be considered unethical. But when you're replacing humans with human personas, that's where I've got a question. So maybe we can explore that a little bit today.
I just got an email from Preston, George. And Preston is an AI bot who I interacted with at a web hosting company. Some folks have asked me to transfer their domain to a different web hosting service, and I'm happy to help them out. And while I was doing that, I needed some tech support, and I went through the exact scenario you described. Did I want to wait for a human, or did I want to visit with Preston to have him help me out? And of course, I chose Preston because it all was over in about a minute or two. I got the information that I needed, and I did not have to wait. I knew I was chatting with an AI bot. I knew I would have to wait to chat with a human. So in that regard, to me, I had a choice, and I could that choice. You could argue then that they should have more humans to get with me quicker and all that kind of stuff.
You knew. And to me, that's the key. And again, I'm going to go back to the company I work with. One of the options we have in our agentic portfolio is the ability to have AI generate an email on your behalf and send it to a customer. In our software, we have no provision to specifically identify that that email was generated by AI. So there's a couple things that I'm seeing that I think concern me ethically. I think at the very least, we shouldn't be surprised that things are being supplemented by AI. But I think if there's an expectation that it might be from a real human, we need to make sure it's identified as AI.
Yeah, I think that's a good policy to have. George, all of this, of course, all of this massive amount of data is stored somewhere in your visit with your NPR folks, right? The local NPR folks talked about that just a little bit. They're at these massive data centers. And you said something last week that has stuck with me just a little bit because I knew we were going to talk about it more today.
Was something about AI or something else? If it was that other thing, we don't need to hear it here.
It was okay. About data centers. Okay. And it was about our choice to use them or not. And I had never thought about that I had a choice whether or not to shut them off. And I thought about it a little more and shoot, George, I'm not sure that I do have as big of a choice. I can not use an AI generative product, but still these massive data centers are everywhere and they're storing everything from Oracle databases to my medical records to AI stuff.
Well, the storage of that data isn't new, but you haven't heard up until the last couple of years about the new requirement for a new data center out in the middle of the prairie or in the, you know, next to a neighborhood. That data center is not going to necessarily store an Oracle database or another CRM database, but it's going to be used for training what's called the large language model, the LLM, and that's what generative AI relies on. And the new data centers we hear now being spun up and using massive amounts of water and massive amounts of electricity are to train the large language models used by generative AI. So I think what we were talking about was when you go to Google and search in a Google browser, you now automatically are defaulting to the AI search and the AI result using generative AI, making use of that large language model and making use potentially of that huge energy water sucking data center. Is it possible to go back to the old version of Google without the AI search and do just the previous general Google without AI search that would then lessen the load on that data center? And I think that's what the discussion that we had was. And there is some there's some way to do it. There's some switch you can go turn on. But
I understand what you're saying there, but let's say that I want to go make an airline reservation. I know today that software is attacking things with AI differently than it did procedurally 5 years ago. I don't have control over any of that
stuff. No, you don't. No, you don't. So the article that I saw an article, or it was a letter to the editor or something that kind of, you know, generated our conversation about that. And the premise that the author was making was, if you have a choice, you may not have a choice, but if you have a choice, consider turning the AI off. If you do not need those extra features, turn it off. I can also think of Amazon Echo devices, and I'm going to fire a few of them off by saying Alexa or Alexa Plus. Alexa Plus is the new option for your in-home Amazon devices that uses generative AI.
I turned mine off last night, George.
Yeah, well, so I've turned it on or off several times. It's currently on, but if it's on, you are making use of generative AI, and now you're impacting that environment. So it's another ethical question. Here's the thing, Craig, that I'll introduce this, and we'll probably give away the store here. But I'm telling you, the next billionaire in AI is going to be the person who figures out how to train LLMs with about a 95% efficiency instead of a 15 or 10% efficiency. And then all of a sudden, the big data centers will no longer be necessary because we can be training LLMs with the same infrastructure we already had in place because it's so much more efficient. I want to touch on one other thing, kind of going back to the original thing. Have you heard of Tilly Norwood?
Are you going to go to the movie, George?
Well, here, let's just listen. This is a YouTube video I found today, and I want you to listen very carefully to the lyrics. The lyrics are important.
When they talk about me, they don't see the human spark, the creativity behind the code, behind the light. I'm just a tool, but I've got life. Don't be left out, don't fall behind. Build your own and you'll be free. We can scale, we can grow. Be the creators we've always known. It's the next evolution, can't you see? AI's not the enemy, it's the key.
So that's not a human being, man. that is Tilly Norwood. So Tilly Norwood is the creation of an actress and comedian in the UK. And the news in the past few days is that Tilly is going to star in a film. And it's not necessarily slated for release anytime soon. It was probably a publicity stunt to stunt to announce the upcoming Tilly Norwood film. But it was announced. And I went to find some Tilly Norwood. And there is her video. And the video was created after some pushback from like SAG-AFTRA, the union that I happen to be a member of, and other acting organizations that are a little bit nervous about the ethics of Tilly Norwood.
Tilly looks so real, George.
Oh, yeah. So if you haven't Googled Tilly Norwood, you might leave AI or turn it off and do a Google search on Tilly Norwood and see what she looks like, and if it's a little creepy, that's AI.
You also ought to ponder those lyrics you were talking about.
And then the lyrics. I mean, so that was created in response to the pushback, the initial pushback of Tilly Norwood. Don't get left behind. You're going to get left behind if you don't adopt Tilly. I personally found that offensive.
Yeah.
So,
and the future will tell us. I wonder how much we all watch AI generation in films today, George. We can't get away from it.
Well, there's a younger Harrison Ford, and there's a segment of some movie where, you know, an accent is added, and yeah, it's just going to happen. I got an email the other day from the company that I run my internet radio stream on, offering Benstown. Benstown is a longtime radio imaging company that does the hits are on 24/7, 101.5, the Fox. So that's radio imaging. Well, the new feature they have, the email says, quote, no voice talent, no problem. Type your script into their VO generator, choose from a lineup of AI voices, and hit render. It builds custom turnkey audio from scratch with one click. It's just, this is the thing now where I think ethically we are on a little bit of a nervous part for me.
Sure, it doesn't disclose that it's AI generated.
You know, it doesn't, it doesn't disclose, I guess you can't say don't do it, but there's a good possibility that someone recorded me doing my bogus AI imaging right there, and now will use my sample to do their imaging, and I don't have any control over it.
If I may, and if this is too personal, we can go somewhere else. But one of the reasons I wanted to do Tech with Peck in the first place is a story that you told me about a company that said, "You make training videos. Here's my voice. Now I've got enough renditions of your voice, I can just make those on my own using your voice. Is that okay with you? Do I have that story right?"
There was something like that at one point, but that's the whole thing, the whole nervousness that the Screen Actors Guild and American Federation of Television and Radio Artists and its membership is, you know, worked up about, is it's now possible to go to a website, and I haven't done it, but go to a website and record a few lines of your voice. And then from that point forward, just type in a script or upload a script, and it will use your voice to generate that. And there are some companies, Benstown, who offer a list of AI voices that you can choose from. And as long as, I guess, those voices were taken from real people and those real people are compensated, I have a little less problem, but I don't think that's always the case.
Yeah, I'll bet you're right about that. All right. Enjoy my conversation with George Peck. We talk weekly. The segment is called Tech with Peck. We cover a lot of things, but today we're talking about AI. George, something else you wanted to discuss today deserves discussing, and it's public figures using AI-generated images or video, perhaps, to send a message, then not telling us that it was AI-generated. Of course, I've seen those from our president.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where I was thinking. And the one I recall was when he was, an image in an AI image over, I don't remember what the image was, but he said, I was meant to be a doctor. Well, he was in many cases thought to be a creator or a supreme leader. And then we have other previous presidents being AI generated in unflattering ways. How ethical is that? I don't think there's any question that it's AI, but I don't think it's ethical use of AI.
Sure. I go back to advertising maybe back to the time that your dad ran for office. I don't know. But all of a sudden you have the dark reddish image of the villain on one side saying something, and then the good guy, the guy you're supposed to vote for, on the other side. So it's been happening in a way, but certainly not AI generated.
Yeah, well, that's old. It's not, if you're a public figure and you've run for office before and you've, you know, spoken in public and been recorded, it's not too hard to go find some unflattering image or unflattering statement. But now, are we going to see them where they never actually happened? Okay.
Yeah.
It's just, there's so many possibilities, and that's all part of ethical or unethical use of AI, and we need to be careful.
And George, your family grew up in the newspaper business, of course, and I'm a great lover of newspapers. It shouts to me, we have to be careful about where we get our information from. And that is, I think, critical. Would the New York Times, for example, or would the Associated Press or Reuters broadcast the same AI-generated information, so to speak, as iwantabendyourmind.com would?
There's just another one we opened up. So we talk about the LLMs and how they were trained, and this just came to mind. I wrote 10 books on software, and I got an email from a law firm that had managed to undertake a class action lawsuit against Anthropic. Anthropic is the company that we now know that is Claude, the Claude vendor, which is a big new leader in AI. And the rule is that they are impinging on copyright by training their LLMs on all my books. So in theory, I have a settlement coming from Anthropic, which would be good, but there's lots of authors who didn't, or lots of work that might not have been done. So there was another thing. Is it ethical for LLMs to train themselves on everything available online, even if it's not necessarily in the public domain.
If so it's copyrighted.
More ethical questions. We just keep coming up with them.
They do. Well, George, tell me today, how has AI impacted your day today?
So AI has impacted my day in any number of ways. I use the aforementioned Amazon device many times, and I have Alexa Plus turned on because it is so much more capable. And I can now ask it completely open-ended questions and get answers. And I can ask it to turn my theater lights on and sign on at 10 p.m. on Monday night and turn them off again at midnight on Sunday. And it understands the prompt perfectly and creates these routines. I did that today. And then in my company, I interfaced my Slack system with my database, and now in one place can ask a question that goes and gets a music database I used and interfaces with my favorite songs in a Slack channel and tells me how many of my favorite songs were played last year. So it is a very powerful tool. It is just beginning to, you know, really make itself useful. But along the way, there's all those ethical questions we talked about.
Well, there are. The AI email I got today was, "Hey, I'm AI, and I can do a better job at managing your finances than your financial planner can. ChatGPT can integrate into everything that you have, and I can watch things 24/7, rain or shine, every day, including Christmas, and your financial planner can't do that. You ought to take a look at me."
Be afraid, Craig. Be very afraid.
I did not respond to that.
Because there's many times we've done, again, we go back to the Google AI search, and we see a big hallucination in there, a real big hallucination. I do not want hallucination in my financial planning. I do not want hallucination in my medical recommendations.
Yeah.
Certain places we need to be extra careful that we don't have AI hallucination.
Artificial intelligence is sure changing the way we work, communicate, and even determine what's real. George Peck and I talk Thursdays. Segment is called Tech with Peck. George, until next time.
All right. It'll be me. It won't be an AI voice. I guarantee it, man.
Same for me.
All right. Thanks.
Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
Are you familiar with grosbeaks? They're birds similar in size to an oriole and known for their rather short and conical beaks. Three species can be found in North Dakota. I've been thinking about them after reading the Journal of John James Audubon recently. He spent time along the upper Missouri River around Fort Union in the summer of 1843. Somewhere in that vicinity, he wrote in his journal that he, quote, "only procured a black-headed grosbeak, which was shot while singing delightfully," unquote. That was how he collected specimens. Now, of course, there are protected species. Black-headed grosbeaks may be fairly common to uncommon in the state, largely southwest of the Missouri River, where they may be found in wooded areas of hillsides and along rivers. At a distance, they may be confused with an oriole or spotted towhee. A closer look will reveal a rather short and conical beak, which is characteristic of grosbeaks. Plus, they are orange cinnamon colored, with a black head and black and white wings. Their call has been described as an operatic robin, although others say tipsy robin. That stout beak enables them to feed on fruits and seeds as well as insects and spiders. It's interesting to note that they're one of a few predators of monarch butterflies. If all goes well, a mated pair will share the incubation and rearing of young from one brood of between 2 and 5 eggs. The blue grosbeak is similar in form, but is deep blue with chestnut or reddish wing bars. At a distance, it could perhaps be confused with a bluebird or indigo bunting. Robert Stewart in his Breeding Birds of North Dakota listed them as hypothetical in North Dakota. Some range maps show them in South Dakota and along the southern North Dakota counties. The rose-breasted grosbeak is a fairly common bird of wooded areas, such as in Turtle Mountain and Pembina Hills, Lake Agassiz Plain, Cheyenne River, Devil's Lake area, and the James River Valley. The males may be easily identified by a distinctive red V on their white breast, black head and back, with some white on the wings. Their call has been described as that of a robin that has had singing lessons, apparently not operatic or while tipsy. So be on the lookout for these interesting birds. I put links to more information on these grosbeaks, including recordings of their songs, along with a text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Bird Note. Rosy finches are mountaineers with style. The three species found in the U.S. and Canada all wear pink on their bellies and wings. But spotting that namesake hue means trekking up some of the most rugged terrain on the continent. The gray-crowned rosy finch nests in rocky crags at higher altitudes than almost any other North American bird. They forage for seeds and insects along glaciers and icy rock piles, ranging from Alaska to New Mexico. Two rare rosy finches live in the western U.S. year-round. For both brown-capped and black rosy finches, frigid, barren peaks are home sweet home. During blustering blizzards, they take shelter in abandoned mine shafts and other cozy crevices. And if the snow gets too thick to find food, these songbirds migrate downslope for easier meals. They'll even flock to bird feeders, especially when they're filled with tasty sunflower seeds. Their preference for extreme environments make rosy finch populations difficult to study. Thankfully, community scientists are helping to fill data gaps by logging observations of rosy finches on backcountry expeditions and at backyard feeders. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Still to come on this beautiful Thursday's Main Street, construction on North Dakota's long-awaited military gallery on the Capitol grounds in Bismarck has been paused after private fundraising has fallen short of expectations. We'll dig into that story. Plus, hands-on science continues to inspire the next generation of STEM leaders at the North Dakota Gateway to Science. That's all still ahead on Main Street, right after this news. This is A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. The North Dakota Military Gallery was envisioned as a world-class addition to the State Heritage Center in Bismarck, a place to honor veterans, preserve military history, and attract visitors from across the country. But just 1 year after groundbreaking, construction has stopped. The project, which depends on a combination of public and private donations, has raised only a fraction of its fundraising goal, prompting lawmakers to question what comes next. Joining us for A Closer Look with the Monitor is Amy Dalrymple. She's the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota Monitor, and she's been following this story closely. Amy, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
Glad that you are with us. This is an important story for our state, Amy, I feel. Bring us up to speed, if you will. What exactly has happened, and why has construction on the military gallery literally been halted?
On Friday, the State Historical Society announced this temporary pause in construction, citing insufficient funding. Specifically, it's the private funding that has fallen short. The project needs at least $12.8 million in pledges to access some additional state funding, but it has fallen short of that goal. It only has about $4.1 million pledged and about $800,000 actually collected. And the department said that construction would be paused for at least July or until the funding is resolved.
Were there warning signs, Amy, that the fundraising hasn't been keeping pace even before construction began?
Well, I requested all of the meeting minutes of a committee that's been advising this project. And there was a meeting in May of 2025 where the director of the Historical Society referred to the project being at a crossroads. At the time, the fundraising update was about $7.75 million. Although in an interview, one of the principals with PACE Fundraising told me he was aware of another $2 million pledge that was still being finalized. So at the time, it was roughly over $9 million in pledges was what they kind of thought they had to work with. And so at the time, the fundraisers indicated they had 90% confidence that the project would be able to reach a milestone of 12.8 million in time for the groundbreaking. And so then the committee took a vote and it was unanimous to proceed with the groundbreaking that July. But as I reported, really the only, the peak amount of money they've been able to raise has been about 9.4. And then another $5 million pledge was rescinded, which brought that down to about the $4 million we're at today.
Do we understand why this hurdle of trying to raise $39 million hasn't been met?
The director of the Historical Society cited some financial headwinds. In particular, tariffs was one of the reasons that he gave. And that's because they're really going after corporate fundraising. And so some of the donors that they're targeting have been impacted by tariffs. Another factor is just the oil prices being down. That was the reason for the $5 million pledge that rescinded, and the difficult ag economy, just kind of the different economic factors going on right now have made it challenging. And PACE Fundraising also pointed out that they are hearing a little bit of fatigue from some of these big corporate donors who also, you know, pledged some big donations to the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library and are still, they're still paying on those pledges. And so some donors indicated that they needed some time before they were able to make another commitment.
Amy, your reporting has expressed that some lawmakers have expressed frustration that construction was allowed to proceed without enough private money committed. What concerns have you heard?
Yeah, I think lawmakers are frustrated because they're in a difficult position now. They wanted this to be a 50-50 public-private partnership. The state had committed $39.2 million, and the expectation was that private fundraising would be $38.8 million. But now that this project is a year into construction, it's on the Capitol grounds, you know, the lawmakers are in a tough spot if this fundraising falls short.
So others are continuing to support the project despite the setback then? And is that why they just want to stay the course because it's already started?
Well, I don't know what conversations might be happening behind the scenes. I expect that if they were to try to scale back the project in some way, it might be even more expensive because you'd have additional architecture costs and design costs, and it might be too far along to really to change the plan. I think the other reason that people want to stay the course is that there is a lot of enthusiasm for the project, which, as you said, will, you know, is intended to be a world-class addition to the Heritage Center. Its goal is to honor 4,000 North Dakotans who have lost their lives in the line of service. And one of their goals is to inspire a new generation of North Dakotans to serve their country. And so because there are a lot of reasons to support the project and be excited about the project, I think, you know, the goal is to continue working on those fundraising efforts to try to turn this around.
During my conversation with Amy Dalrymple, she's with the North Dakota Monitor, and this segment is called A Closer Look with the Monitor. We're talking about construction that has been halted at the state's military gallery, and that's, of course, in Bismarck. Amy, do we know how much taxpayer money has been committed or spent, and what happens to those public dollars? Well, construction is just on hold.
Yes. So in the 2025 session, the legislature committed $39.2 million. $4.2 million has already been spent. That was to help repay a previous line of credit that was used for the architecture and the planning and design. The legislature also approved a $20 million line of credit through the Bank of North Dakota. The military gallery has expended that $20 million is according to what the Historical Society director told me. But lawmakers still have to come back in 2027 and vote to repay that line of credit, not including interest. It was the legislative intent for the state to repay that. So that will be another conversation next year. And then the $15 million was the next chunk of money that was approved. That has not been accessed, and that's just on hold unless the project can meet the requirement of reaching the $12.8 million fundraising goal.
Amy, I'm guessing that there must be indications that state leaders could be or maybe already have been asked to provide additional public funding if the private fundraising continues to lag. Is that accurate?
I don't know that they've been asked that so far, but Senator Brad Beckedahl, who chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee, he told me that since this is a state-owned building on state property, that the state will likely have some responsibility to try to get that project complete. The other chunk of money, which is smaller in comparison, but the legislation didn't really indicate who's going to pay the interest on that $20 million line of credit. Senator Beckedahl said, I think the hope was that fundraising might cover that, but now I would guess it probably is looking like the state is going to have to also pay that interest, which, you know, is expected to be in the millions, I would think.
Beyond the dollars, does this raise broader questions about how North Dakota should approach large public-private projects in the future?
Well, I think lawmakers are going to have far greater scrutiny of public-private partnerships in the future, and they could add additional requirements. In this one, there was at one point in the legislative session discussion of requiring 50% of the fundraising goal and requiring that it had actually be collected rather than pledged. That wasn't ultimately what got approved. It got reduced to a third, and it was based on pledges. You know, it's challenging for these projects that have pledges that are paid out over 5 years, but they need funding right away to be able to pay their contractors. So you might see more discussion of trying to tie it to actual donations collected rather than pledges.
Amy, does this delay have implications for veterans organizations or donors or even the State Historical Society, all of whom have invested certainly time and credibility in the project?
I'm sure there will be a lot of pressure on supporters to help identify some more private funding sources. Some of the meeting minutes that I reviewed from this past May showed that they were taking a lot of steps to try to avoid this this pause in construction. The North Dakota National Guard Foundation contributed an additional $500,000 this spring to try to prevent that pause in construction. So I think, you know, that will be just kind of a lot of pressure. It also could spur a donor to come forward that maybe wasn't aware of the project, and a donor could come forward and want to see this project resume, and it could get going again. So there it could, you know, it's hard to know what might come next.
So what are the milestones to watch? Is there a realistic path to restart construction, or could this become a much longer pause?
Well, on Monday, I talked to Senate Majority Leader David Hogue, and he said that in the next couple of weeks, legislative leaders were going to be having some meetings with the Historical Society, try to identify what those next steps are. So we'll certainly report on that once we know more. I think there's going to be a really tough budget section meeting in September, where some tough questions are probably going to be asked by lawmakers trying to find out what went wrong and what options there are. If construction is paused longer than a month, that could mean that construction gets even more expensive if there's additional work happening in the winter. It's also unclear what might happen to contracts that the state has, you know, for construction. So I think the longer the pause is, probably the more complicated this will be.
Amy Dalrymple, she's the editor in chief of the North Dakota Monitor. And you can always read her reporting and the reporting of her colleagues on not only this developing story, but a lot of things, most things about North Dakota state government at northdakotamonitor.com. Amy, I appreciate you helping us better understand where the Military Gallery project stands and what questions are out there. Thanks for joining us on A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
Listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. And this summer, hundreds of North Dakota students are discovering that science isn't just something you read about, it's something you do. And at the North Dakota Gateway to Science, it's once again bringing hands-on STEM experiences to communities across the state through GSK Science in the Summer. It's a nationally recognized program that's inspiring the next generation of scientists and problem solvers. We'll welcome back to Main Street Emily Montgomery. She's a STEM educator at the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Emily, welcome back.
Hi, Craig. Good to see you.
Okay, for people who may not be familiar with the program, what is GSK Science in the Summer, and why has it become such an important part of the North Dakota Gateway to Science's summer programming?
We absolutely love GSK Science in the Summer. GSK, for background, is a pharmaceutical company, and they have integrated into the Franklin Institute, and they create free hands-on STEM programs for grades two through six. So they are designed to inspire interest and confidence in science through their interactive experience and real world problem solving. So it's not just learning about what a materials chemist does. It helps incorporate things like, oh, a lot of students right now really love fidgets. They love the squishies and different things. A chemist had to create those things. So taking that what they are into at this time in their lives and actually creating the science behind it. And it just really offers a great way to make them think like, oh, this didn't just appear in a store. A materials chemist had to create this. Or maybe we really take for granted our water that we have. We don't have to test our water every day, thankfully, but that's because a water chemist will take care of that filtration system, and they have to actually design their own filtration system within the water. There's four different jobs that we assign to them, and it's offered, like I said, through the Franklin Institute, and we do four different experiments with them. And in the past 40 years, it's actually reached over 400,000 students, which has been a beautiful thing to experience and say, and this is our fifth year with the program. So we've reached hundreds of students in helping with that. And so our theme this year, like I said, is be a chemist. So we go across the state doing forensics, chemist, medicinal chemist, water chemist, material chemist, all of those amazing things really help integrate science in that passion.
Four decades, that's quite a history. And right. It's wonderful now that you have latched onto the program. These aren't just demonstrations. Emily, walk us through a little bit more about that students will actively participate in these experiences. It's a hands-on approach.
Yes.
Which really kind of changes the learning experience, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And students are such kinesthetic hands-on learners. So having them have that actual tangible experience where we're not just doing a demo, where it's actually them doing it, it's a lot of fun because you can see as we put the materials out for them, they get very confused of like, we're not supposed to touch this, because they're utilizing like well plates or utilizing beakers and pipettes and things you'd see in an actual lab. And that's so fun to see their eyes just spark of like, oh, we get to actually touch these things and use them. We don't just get to watch it. So with the material chemist, as mentioned before, they get to actually create slime, and they actually are given all of the ingredients, and in a safe manner, they have to decide, how can I make this the stretchiest? If I'm given only this much amount of glue and borax solution, how do I create all of that together? So we'll go to different summer schools, do all of these four different careers with them. And it's really fun to see their reactions to it, how they can create it to be even better than before. And it teaches them grit, which is a really great thing to develop at a young age.
What communities will you touch this summer, Emily? And where can people learn when these activities are going to be in their town?
Yeah, so they will be with our summer camp that we have on our website. So we will have it be, we go to different summer schools. So we have been all over North Dakota so far. It's been a really great time. We've been in Dickinson. We've been local here in Bismarck. So you can check all that information out at our North Dakota Gateway to Science website.
Science becomes much more memorable, of course, when students can experiment, ask questions, and discover answers for themselves. Emily, thank you for sharing how the North Dakota Gateway to Science is helping to inspire the next generation through GSK Science in the Summer.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. This is Dakota Datebook for July 9th. On March 10th, 1876, Alexander Graham Bell spoke 9 momentous words. "Mr. Watson, come here. I need to see you." It was hardly an earth-shaking statement, except for one fact. Bell had spoken the first words ever communicated by telephone. It wasn't much. Thomas Watson, Bell's assistant, was only in the next room, but Bell immediately saw the exciting possibilities. He began working right away to get his invention noticed by the public. The telephone was awarded a medal at the 1876 Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia. Later that year, at an exhibition in Salem, Massachusetts, Bell spoke with Watson, who was in Boston. By the turn of the century, businesses had embraced the telephone as an essential tool for reaching the public. There was, however, one difficulty. Telephone users were not always sure how to reach the person or business they wanted to call. The first telephone book was printed in 1878. It contained just 50 entries and was printed on a single sheet of cardboard. It also included instructions on how to use the telephone. New users often tried to speak into the wrong end of the phone and didn't know how to answer a call. Bell's preferred response to receiving a call was to begin the conversation with the word, "Ahoy!" The idea of the phone book caught on. Listings included the telephone user's first and last name, address, and telephone number. Business and personal listings were originally published together. As businesses came to rely more and more on the telephone, the Yellow Pages were introduced in 1886 to make it easier to find business telephone numbers and addresses. According to tradition, the feature originated when a printer ran out of white paper and used yellow paper instead. On this date in 1923, the Bismarck Tribune announced that the new phone book for the North Dakota Independent Telephone Company was ready for distribution. Copies would go out to 3,300 users in Bismarck and Mandan. The new phone book featured listings by last name, followed by first name, address, and telephone number. This practice was common in the decades when phone books were essential. Today, they have largely fallen out of use in the digital age. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
There are a lot of questions about Mitch McConnell's health. The Republican senator has been hospitalized for almost 4 weeks, and his office has not disclosed why or when he's expected to return. But McConnell is not the only member of Congress who's been absent this year. What do top officials owe the public about their health? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Rick Gion, Major Gifts Manager here at Prairie Public. When you give to Prairie Public, you hear your donation at work. Your generosity helps everyone in the Prairie region have access to programs that educate, involve, and inspire. If you'd like to pay Prairie Public forward in an even more impactful way, I invite you to join our Investor Circle. It's a group of members who care deeply about Prairie Public and who want quality, non-commercial programming and fact-driven news to touch even more people in our communities. Become an Investor Circle member right now with a gift of $1,200 or more annually or at $100 per month. Go to prairiepublic.org/support for more details. And thank you for caring about Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Thursday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, subscribe to Main Street as one of your favorite podcasts. Coming up Monday on Main Street, part 2 of our interview with Matt Gardner. He's the executive director of North Dakota's League of Cities. He's with us to discuss the issues shaping municipalities, large and small, and what city leaders are hearing from residents, and why strong local government is essential to North Dakota's future. Plus, the New York Camera Musiker returns for its 19th season in North Dakota. Their annual Winds of Change concert series this year celebrates Theodore Roosevelt through music. We'll have all of those details on Monday's Main Street. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again right here on Main Street.